loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the United Nations is calling on Russia, Iran, and Turkey to not attack the Syrian province of Idlib until humanitarian corridors can be created to evacuate some of the millions of civilians there. But the truth is that an attack on Syria could just as easily come from the United States, Britain, and France. Are we looking at another Suez crisis? Next, shocking new reports have emerged that U.S. citizens who were born near the U.S.-Mexico border on the American side are being denied U.S. passports. This on the false allegation that they are not, in fact, U.S. citizens. Then, the Trump administration is expected to replace a major Obama-era environmental regulation on the emission of mercury, a pollutant linked to damage of the brain, the nervous system, and fetal development, with a much weaker regulation. And then, the New York gubernatorial race between Governor Andrew Cuomo and former actress Cynthia Nixon turned ugly, quickly, in the first debate last night between the two Democrats. Meanwhile, Cuomo received a $25,000 donation from the law firm representing accused sexual predator Harvey Weinstein immediately before suspending an investigation into whether the Weinstein probe was mishandled. And finally, environmental groups yesterday argued in a federal appeals court that the Environmental Protection Agency should revoke its approval of a potent weed killer because it evaporates quickly, destroys nearby crops, and kills wildlife. The groups say that Monsanto's Xtendimax weed killer is a health hazard and should be banned immediately. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the situation in Syria. The United Nations is calling on Russia, Iran, and Turkey to not attack the Syrian province of Idlib until humanitarian corridors can be created to evacuate some of the millions of civilians there. But the truth is that an attack on Syria could just as easily come from the United States, Britain, and France. Are we looking at another Suez crisis? We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. Ambassador, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Ambassador, so much of the press is focused on the Iranians, the Russians, the Turks, the Syrians, the terrorists, the Kurds, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like none of us are looking at ourselves, the Americans, the British, and the French. What do you think is happening in Syria right now?
John, let me just tell the audience
yes,
that Ambassador Ford has just published a really
indeed
important article
important
on Middle East Eye, that's EYE.net. And the title of his article is a Syrian Suez approaching? And of course, it's an allusion to the British, French, Israeli aggression against Egypt in 1956.
That's right.
I just, Ambassador Ford, I just tweeted your article separately because I think it's a really, really important contribution, a raising awareness at a critical moment, a hot moment, maybe.
Thanks for doing that. Yeah, I mean, we are just days away from the anniversary of how the Suez crisis kicked off. It kicked off on 1 September 1956 with France secretly but officially requesting Israel to attack Egypt to provide a pretext for France, and Britain came in soon after, a pretext to invade Egypt and take control of the Suez Canal. So there's kind of a dual similarity with today's situation. Again, it's three major powers about to attack, apparently, a vulnerable Middle East country. And again, they're using subterfuge. If the reports coming from Russian sources are correct, and I believe they are, that a fabricated incident involving alleged use of chemical weapons is in the works. So the similarities are there, and the seriousness of the situation today does, I believe, bear comparison with that very serious crisis in 1956.
Yeah, Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. We're talking about Syria. It appears that the Syrian government is on the verge of retaking the city of Idlib in the northern part of Syria. If that were to happen, that would essentially be the end of the armed opposition. It would be the victory of the Syrian government. Peter Ford has written an article that you can find at Middle East Eye, that's EYE.net. And in the article, I want to read a couple sentences to you, because for the U.S., Britain, and France to work together to carry out a tripartite aggression in Syria, of course, a pretext is necessary. You can't just say, we, the former colonizers of the Middle East, along with the United States, intend to reconquer you. There has to be a noble pretext. In this case, I'm going to read now a couple sentences from Peter Ford's article. The three governments in April staged a rehearsal for the upcoming performance, responding with bombing raids to the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma, while plan A for the raids involved heavy attacks on presidential offices. That would mean killing the president. And armed forces command and control centers. President Donald Trump was reportedly talked down from this by Secretary of State James Mattis, concerned by the prospect of possible clashes with Russia and risks to U.S. forces stationed in Syria. But Ambassador Ford, those were your words from your new article. We also had John Bolton coming out in the media just about 10 days ago, I believe, saying, if there is another chemical weapons attack, this time the U.S. will go in and do something really decisive in Syria, not like the last time, what John McCain might have called a pinprick operation, just 59 cruise missiles, something bigger. And it seemed like an open invitation to do just that, to have the armed terrorist organizations, which are about to be defeated, to stage some sort of attack. And then the U.S., Britain, and France, using a noble pretext, could come in. That's what's going on.
Exactly. The intentions could hardly be made more plain. And almost every day that passes provides new evidence. I think just yesterday, the CNN Pentagon reporter was saying, relaying his feed from the Pentagon, that Assad is preparing a chemical weapons attack, and he's moved up his attack helicopters, ready to drop barrel bombs. No, they really are ramping up the conditioning. And significantly, this didn't happen with the recent recovery by the Assad forces of the south, where personally I was kind of expecting an alleged chemical weapons attack. But we didn't get this conditioning, and we didn't get reports of the preparation for a chemical attack. So this convinces me that this time it's for real, and we better brace ourselves. We better stand by for a crisis much more serious than the Douma crisis, unless we raise our voices loudly enough.
We have a situation, Ambassador Ford, where we have Iranian military forces, Hezbollah, of course, but notably the Russian military. And the Russian military and the U.S. military have been coordinating for a long time. I mean, I think maybe as many as a dozen times a day, at least at the, I think maybe we discussed this with you, at the level of the colonels, you know, having like discussions, deconfliction discussions, so that both countries are not accidentally killing each other's troops or destroying each other's equipment. Where will Russia be in all of this?
Well, Russia is deeply embedded in the Syrian forces themselves, so that any tripartite attack against, for example, command and control centers, and even presidential offices, there's going to be a Russian presence there. Now, the U.S. may think that they can make a phone call, hey, you guys have got 12 hours to get out of the way, we're going to bomb. What happens if the Russians say, niet, we ain't moving? This is developing into a Cuba. This is developing into a Cuba-style crisis.
And then you have an international crisis on your hands.
The three have not given themselves an escape ramp. They had an escape ramp with Douma because there was the option of limited strikes. Apparently, Bolton was urging Trump, this is according to the Wall Street Journal, an impeccable source, I'm sure you'll agree, Bolton was urging Trump to go for the maximal option A, bomb the hell out of them. But Mattis sensibly talked them down. But they said afterwards, after it was all over, hey, if this happens again, we are going to bomb much more heavily. And Bolton has been reiterating that threat. So so that there is now no escape ramp. They can't go for option B.
And you know, the other thing, Ambassador Ford, and in his article, is making the comparison or the analogy to what happened with the Suez Crisis in 1956. There was another exit ramp in 1956, and the exit ramp included two parties. One was the Soviet Union. I think Nikita Khrushchev said famously, "How would London like missiles landing in London," or something like that, meaning the Soviets were standing with Nasser. But the United States government also opposed, the Eisenhower administration opposed the Israeli, French, and British plan. That was before Israel was purely like an extension of American power, when it was still a different sort of status. So that was the exit ramp there, Peter Ford. America said no at that time, and Soviet Union said no, and they backed out, these lesser powers. But the U.S. is the world hegemon now. There's nobody saying, you know, there's no exit ramp there.
That's right. In a sense, it's the Russians who are trying to exercise some adult supervision here, as the U.S. did back in 1956. But this time, Russia is also a direct player. There is no escape ramp. Unless someone sensible, General Mattis, are you listening here?
We've heard rumors that Mattis always tunes into Loud and Clear between 4 and 6 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday.
On his commute home.
Because you can hear it in the Washington area at 105.5 FM. I hope he is listening to Peter Ford.
I hope he is, and learning something. We're going to have to leave it there, though. That was Ambassador Peter Ford. He joined us from the United Kingdom, and he's the former British ambassador to Syria. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back right after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Shocking new reports have emerged that U.S. citizens who were born near the U.S.-Mexico border on the U.S. side are being denied American passports on the basis that they are not, in fact, U.S. citizens. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia. She's co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isabel and John, I have to tell you, this story, this is a major story in the Washington Post.
Oh, yes.
The headline is U.S. denying passports to Americans along the border, throwing their citizenship into question, which, of course, you can't actually throw somebody's citizenship into question. You're either a citizen or not. But the other thing is, these are people who are having the passport renewals denied. They already have U.S. passports.
Yeah, right.
And we're talking about a large number of people. Go ahead, Isabel.
We're talking about a clearly racist move. I think begins with Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller is behind the scenes, never see him, looking through laws and policies that can be utilized in a very racist and exclusive manner, especially along the U.S.-Mexico border. How dare he attack binational community members that have lived in Nogales. It's called the Ambos Nogales, you know, where one town means two Nogaleses come together. We have been here generations. My family here has been here six generations, and we know dozens and dozens and dozens of families that are border people, born in border towns. Now they're going to tell us that the hospital records in Douglas or in Nogales or now are not going to be accepted now. I mean, talk about a racist move and a move that really people should question in terms of where are we spending our money? Where are we spending our money? We want to create crises where there is no crisis. And we warned against this, right? I mean, these guys have a lot of positions to get busy with, and migration continues in all-time lows, and they've got millions of agents that they've got policies to enforce, I believe, that come from the very top. How dare they do this? I had mentioned to Walter earlier that I know communities, entire communities, that live on the other side of the border. You know, they're fronterizos too. They're Mexican. They're not trying to become U.S. Citizens and such. And they have a lot more connection to the country, to this area of the country, than Steve Miller ever would in his entire life, and Martha McSally and all of those running along this border as if they know the border. They know nothing of the border. They weren't even born and raised here. You know, I'm telling you, this is a direct attack at the Mexican-American community. He's not done with us, right? He's not done attacking us, having impact on our school kids, on society as a whole. He's continuing an attack, and to try to like denaturalize people, de-citizenship white people, is beyond the pale. It's beyond the pale, and we need to put a stop to it. How dare they detain anyone? I've read some of the stories. It's an outrage.
Isabel Garcia is our guest. We're talking about a large number of American citizens who are being denied passports or passport renewals by the Trump administration on the basis that they may not, in fact, be U.S. citizens. Now, I want to read the first couple lines from this Washington Post story. And again, the headline is, the U.S. is denying passports to Americans along the border, throwing their citizenship in question. It comes from today. It's August 29th. Here's some of the words. On paper, he's a devoted U.S. citizen. His official American birth certificate shows he was delivered by a midwife in Brownsville, Texas, at the southern tip of the state. He spent his life wearing American uniforms. 3 years as a private in the U.S. Army, then as a cadet in the Border Patrol, and now as a state prison guard. But when Juan, age 40, applied to renew his U.S. passport this year, the government's response floored him. In a letter, the State Department said it didn't believe he was an American citizen. Now, here's a further down in the article. When Juan, the former soldier, received a letter from the State Department telling him it wasn't convinced that he was a U.S. citizen, it requested a range of obscure documents, evidence of his mother's prenatal care, this would have been 41 years ago, his baptismal certificate, rental agreements from when he was a baby. He managed to find some of those documents, but weeks later received another denial. In a letter, the government said the information, quote, did not establish your birth in the United States, close quote. Quote, I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to have to seek legal help, said Juan, who earns $13 an hour as a prison guard and expects to pay several thousand dollars in legal fees. This is what's going on in the USA.
Yeah.
This is...
It's an outrage.
And this is a slippery slope, too, where you have an official birth certificate, you were clearly born in the United States, and you have to essentially prove a negative. You have to prove that you were not born somewhere else.
You have to show them your mother's prenatal care documents. Yeah, for Juan, right. He's 40, from 41 years
ago. Good luck with that.
So we can't even cross into Mexico without fear that when we're crossing back because of the color of our skin, because we're Mexican-American, they're going to question our citizenship.
Yeah.
As a defense attorney, I represented Canadian citizens caught with drugs, and they told me it was so easy for white Canadians to go and smuggle drugs, and they were never, ever, ever bothered. Can you imagine? We are foreigners in our own land. Six generations in my family, and we're asked for papers at the checkpoints left and right. This is an outrage, and it is a slippery slope. But we have to understand that the Border Patrol and the higher-ups like Miller have some very clear goals, and that is to disrupt our community, to try to deport as many of us, to try to criminalize as many of us, and really have the country in this mode of being Border Patrol themselves, right? They've got this vision of all of us questioning each other. Very dangerous.
Isabel, in 1970, the U.S. Latino population was 9.6 million. Today, it's 57 million. The Latino population in the United States was the principal driver of U.S. demographic growth, accounting for the biggest number of people who are changing the composition of the United States. It seems to me that what the Trump administration is trying to do is reverse this pattern. When they say make America great again, they mean different things, but one of the things they mean is with not so many Latinos. But it seems to me that even though there is this extreme racism and harassment, just harassment, and punishment of people based on race or ethnicity, it's a losing cause. The demographics are going to continue to change, and the Republican Party and the racist retrograde elements are going to lose this battle, although they're going to make a lot of people suffer along the way.
They're making a lot of people suffer. They have the example of what we've done, this country has done to African Americans. So, you know, we are going right in that line. We are going to dilute that vote just as they had the Southern strategy in the South to dilute black vote. Yes, the Trump administration is trying to gerrymander, dilute in any way possible that we have any representation, that we have a real democracy. They are trying to defeat the democratic aspects that we do have right now.
Isabel Garcia is our guest. She is right there. She's in the border state, Arizona. She's in Tucson. When we read this story, Isabel, you know, I have to tell you, I was shocked. I was disgusted. I was amazed. I talked to John about it. We talked about it after our editorial meeting. But, you know, I have to tell you the truth. I didn't know anything about it until I read this article.
Yeah, no, this is the first I had heard of it was in this morning's Washington Post. I actually couldn't believe it when I read it because this is America and this isn't supposed to happen
but
here.
But what Isabel's telling us, if I'm right, Isabel, is that you know all about this and so do people all along the border.
Yes. Yes, we've had people criminally prosecuted for illegal reentry and they're U.S. citizens. Imagine that. We've criminalized people who are U.S. citizens and sent them to prison. So this is a direct attack on our community. Stephen Miller has all these little things going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. We know very well that they'd like to, you know, attack the 14th Amendment. They don't want us to have citizenship. So we all better be very careful. As you say, this is a very slippery slope, and they do not want true representation. They want the past.
Yeah, they want the past. They're determined to get it. They're using the most vile means. You know, it's no accident, John. We just had this big protest against the Nazis and KKK and Unite the Rally. We had 15,000 people in Lafayette Park. But it's no accident that the ultra-right white supremacist KKK types, their focus for the last couple of years has been on immigration. Historically, it was directed only or mainly against the black community. But it's directed against immigration because it's dovetailing. They think they have a friend in the White House.
Oh, sure.
And that this thing
They're
can
emboldened.
Grow and grow based on targeting Latinos and in particular Latinos who are immigrants. But also, as we're seeing in this story, Latinos who are U.S. citizens. Anyway, we're completely out of time.
We are out of time, but we were happy to be joined by Isabel Garcia. She joined us from Tucson, Arizona, and she's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is expected to replace a major Obama-era environmental regulation on the emission of mercury, a pollutant linked to damage of the brain, the nervous system, and fetal development, with a much weaker regulation.
That sounds like a good idea.
Seriously.
I don't think we're getting enough mercury in our diet.
I was going to say the same thing, and I'm going to ask our guest exactly that. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Dr. Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont, and he's the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation from Monthly Review Press. Dr. Magdoff, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So this is not a rhetorical question. Why in the world would anybody want more mercury in our system?
It sounds like a Saturday Night Live routine. Can you bring the kids a little more mercury?
It's absurd on every level, you know. the mercury pollution that we have had in the past, and we still have, is primarily coming from coal-burning, electric-generating facilities in the U.S. and abroad. But we in the Northeast used to get a lot from the Midwest plants. Our lakes had a lot of mercury in them. Our soils, of course, have mercury. It's not too bad. It gets tied up in the soils. But that's the reason we're told not to eat too many fish out of a lake. That's the reason why pregnant women are told, not to eat tuna fish or restrict it to very infrequently because of the high concentration of mercury in the oceans. This makes no sense at all. And it's also absolutely absurd because the companies have already spent billions of dollars to comply with it, and they have it all in place. They have the capacity to take out the mercury actually installed. So why not use it? It makes no economic sense at this point.
I didn't know that. Did you know that, Brian?
No.
I had no idea.
No, they're doing it. I mean, they are removing mercury now, and it cost them they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to spend the money to upgrade the facilities with equipment necessary to do this. But they did it because of the regulations. So it's in place.
And then what happens with that mercury? Are they able to reuse it or to sell it for some reason? Or what do they do with it once it's removed?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I'm not, this isn't an area that I normally follow. But what happens with stuff afterwards when they grab it. But at least it's not going into the atmosphere. So if it's in some concentrated form, which it should be, you would think they'd be able to reuse it, or else to handle it as a toxic solid waste, which is at least better than putting it into the atmosphere. It's not great, but it's better than putting it into the atmosphere for everybody to breathe and then to come down in the water and get into our food system.
Yeah, and mercury, some of the mercury that we're dealing with was released years ago. It goes into the land, the water, other surfaces. Of course, when volcanic eruptions happen, that's a source of mercury. There are emissions from the ocean. But as Fred Magdoff is pointing out, the two biggest sources of mercury release, and this is a big problem, are from small-scale gold mining and from coal combustion. And then there's the mining of non-ferrous metals and also cement production. Those are the big four. So, when you think about why would government regulators want to do this? Why would they want to deregulate industries which are not going downhill because of mercury regulations? Why would they do it when they know that mercury is a poisoning element that has long-term consequences, that it can travel? And it seems to me, Fred, that the people making these decisions are people in their late 50s, 60s, 70s. They're rich people. They're connected to industry. They figure it's not going to impact them as individuals or perhaps their families. And they just don't give a damn. And if for Trump, he can make another sort of, he's tipping his hat towards the coal industry.
Oh, sure. This is all for West Virginia and his base.
It's the narrowest possible motivations to allow the poisoning of the planet and its 7 billion people. I mean, you can't get more immoral.
Yeah, no, you're right. But the crazy thing is, it doesn't even make any sense from the company's point of view at this point, because they've already spent the money to be able to take mercury out of the emissions from the from the power plant.
So then what? So is it just public relations? Like, yeah, we're the mercury party. I mean,
well, no, we're it's part of the, I think you're right about the coal industry. It's just another example of that they would say that they're helping the coal industry, where it really doesn't really help them at all. Because it's going to make no difference from the power plant's point of view. They can stop taking it out, but then they've wasted these billions of dollars to build the infrastructure in order to be able to remove the mercury.
When you look at the big concentrations of mercury, we're looking, again, China, Southeast Asia, India, parts of Indonesia, the southeast parts of Africa, the southwest parts of Latin America, Mexico, into the lower southwest, southern parts of California, and then pretty high concentrations in the northeastern states of the United States, and specifically and perhaps most notably in the Great Lakes region. I mean, this is a global problem, but Americans shouldn't think that this isn't going to have a direct impact on them. And again, not because it's actually helping the industries, because as Fred is saying, they've already have
right
the instruments in place.
Right.
To deal
it's not
with
that
it.
The technology doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, even the guy who it's in I think today's Times a story on the Times website, the fellow who's a lawyer who represents the coal burning electric utilities. This is a direct quote from him about eliminating the rule on mercury pollution entirely. It would serve no purpose because the power sector has already spent billions of dollars to bring all their plants into compliance. That's a quote from a lobbyist for the companies.
So it's an interesting political moment, John, where the platform of at least one of the parties is, look, we succeeded in cutting your Medicaid. Many of you have lost access to health care. But we are giving you more mercury. You can count on us. You can count on us. Vote for us in 2018, the Mercury Party.
You know, the crazy thing, too, is that where this coal is mined and processed, places like West Virginia and Kentucky and Pennsylvania and southeastern Ohio, these states all went for Trump anyway. So it's not like he's doing it because he needs to win votes in these states. He's doing it just because he's cynical. He's cynical about the environment. He doesn't care about the environment. He's in the pocket of these big corporations, and this is what we get.
And the lobbying machines who are now staffing all the positions at the EPA, the lobbying machines from all of these industrial, they're the paid hired hands of industrial lobbies or coal mining lobbies. And even if it doesn't make much sense, there's not any regulation that seems to sort of inhibit, obstruct, prevent them from doing what they want to do, which they don't want to undo that regulation. They want to go back to a kind of 19th century capitalism, completely unregulated capitalism. They don't want the government to get in their way, because if they can squeeze one more penny out of anything, they want to do it. And they see regulations as their enemy because of that. They try to dress it up as it's bad for business or whatever, but that's what it really is. Fred, we're winding down in time. Give us the last word here.
Well, it's just it's a horrible thing to even suggest to do this, and it makes no sense from an economic point of view. It's just, I think, part of their as you said, part of their a general approach is to try to deregulate everything possible, whether it makes sense or not, whether it makes economic sense or not, and of course, none of them what they're doing with EPA. Make environmental sense. This is as bad as it gets.
If you go to the EPA website, John, now maybe this has been scrapped. Maybe I'm looking at a cached page from the yesteryear, pre-Trump. Here's what it says. Some communities eat significantly more quantities of fish than the general population, and thus may be exposed to much greater mercury contamination than the general population. It is estimated, this is the EPA, the same part of the same administration that's deregulating this so that we get more mercury. It is estimated that more than 75,000 newborns in the United States each year may have increased risk of learning disabilities associated with in utero exposure to methyl mercury. 75,000 infants, that's 75,000 families. And now you have the government saying, yeah, let's get more mercury. I mean, that's the nature of what we're dealing with right now.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. It's available from Monthly Review Press. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New York gubernatorial race between Governor Andrew Cuomo and former actress Cynthia Nixon turned ugly quickly in the first debate last night between the two Democrats. Meanwhile, Cuomo received a $25,000 donation from the law firm representing accused sexual predator Harvey Weinstein immediately before suspending an investigation into whether the Weinstein probe was mishandled. We're joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Randy, welcome back.
It's always nice to be back with you and Mr. Becker, as Andrew Cuomo would say.
You know, I laughed out loud when I watched this debate last night. They were a minute into it, and Nixon called Cuomo a corrupt liar, and Cuomo said that Nixon lives in a fantasy world, and stop interrupting me. And besides single-payer healthcare, there was very little policy discussed. It was just the two of them attacking one another. Now, Nixon is so far behind in the polls that she has nothing to lose by attacking Cuomo, but Cuomo took the bait, and he went right back after her. What are people saying about this debate and how it ended?
Well, everyone that I spoke to after the debate thought that she came off well and won. And without even seeing it, I would declare that her the winner, because Cuomo is totally corrupt. Andrew Cuomo, he's a terrible debater. You know, it's like the old adage that, you know, strong men have weak children. Well, he's got two weak children, Mario. That's Andrew and his brother Chris, who I call the tale of two Fredos, okay? Fredo Corleones. And I'm Italian, so it's not a bigoted remark. But both of them really underperform. And the father, was basically not that progressive. He gave a great speech at a convention that he read, but he also built 37 prisons when he was governor. All right, he was against the death penalty, but he built 37 prisons. His idea of low-cost housing for people of color, and Andrew was his chief of staff. All right, so I've known Andrew, by the way, for 16 years. He parachuted in on the Rockefeller drug law movement in 2003 and got involved in it. It really revitalized a moribund career, because he had gotten clobbered in 2002. But he slunk out of the primary. And then in 2003, he got Russell Simmons into the Rockefeller stuff. And there's a documentary on it. But it was only opportunistic, which is all he is opportunistic. Once he became attorney general, never mentioned Rockefeller drug laws again. Once he became governor, and I've been on this now for years, he didn't give any clemencies. Now, every governor, every Southern Dixie, whether it be Farbus or Wallace, gave out hundreds of clemencies. This guy is worse. Didn't give out any his first 4 years, and then he gave out some pardons. But these are people that had already served their sentences. He didn't cut anybody loose early, Andrew Cuomo. And that is in 8 years. And he promised me, boy, this is a long answer. I just want you to know why I'm so upset with the guy. He has done nothing to reform the criminal justice system in the state of New York. She went after that last night on the marijuana stuff. But we're talking about beatings in many of the prisons. There's no oversight in the state prison system. You've got white supremacists up in Clinton, white as guards up in Buffalo. And, you know, he's basically owned by the guard union in the New York's 55 detention. I call them like warehouses. And there's 55,000 people in prison in the state of New York, which is 5.5 times what there were during the Attica uprising.
You know, Randy, I hear you about Cynthia Nixon winning the debate and about who Andrew Cuomo is and about the corruption of Andrew Cuomo, the extreme opportunism of Andrew Cuomo. But then I can't tell you, you have to be, of course, we would want the underdog here, the more progressive Cynthia Nixon, to win. But I'm just looking at this part of the debate. Cuomo at one point declared that Donald Trump was one of the main risks to the state of New York. Good point. He is trying to change the rights and values of New Yorkers. And the first line of defense in New York is the governor that leads and fights, and you know how to do it. and you need to know how to do it. That's Cuomo. And then she responds to him and said, you stood up to him, meaning Trump, about as well as he stood up to Putin, Nixon said in an apparent reference to Trump's apparent refusal to endorse the U.S. intelligence community assessment that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. Now, Trump was being condemned by liberals and Democrats for having even met with Putin, even though every president of the United States since Eisenhower has met either with the leader of the Soviet Union or then Russia. I mean, it's a sad day where liberalism, which historically stood for peace between the major powers, is condemning Cuomo for not and Trump for not, quote, standing up to Putin. Again, it's sort of sours the whole thing.
First of all, she has no foreign policy knowledge, and she did the same thing that this guy Avenatti said the other day, that Trump, the only person he answers to, is Putin. All right, so this is a canard they all throw out. They have to use him as a straw man, Putin, and it's really lowbrow politics, and they should definitely not do that. If I've seen her do that before, and I had criticized her on Twitter to stop doing that, because it has nothing to do with the state of New York, and you're fanning the flames of or the passions of war, basically, by doing that. By you keep bringing up Putin. This is such a bad cliche. She should never do that. Cuomo, of course, just his own, where he gets his money, Cuomo, from all of these rich billionaires in the state of New York, whether it be the guy who owns Home Depot, whether it be Goldman Sachs, Leonard Letwin, the billionaire real estate mogul, and all of these other, where he gets most of his money, he is definitely one of the most corrupt governors that we've had, and I can't even think how far we'd have to go back, maybe to Horatio Seymour in 1868.
That's exactly what I was thinking. John Kiriakou, I think I want to give Cynthia Nixon a piece of campaign advice, and I know she's listening and yearning for our advice. And my advice is, Cynthia Nixon, listen to Randy Credico, because Randy actually knows what he's talking about in terms of New York City and New York State politics, and also has this entire thing in perspective.
Very true.
And you know, I do the best Cuomo in the world. I ran against him in 2014, and he likes to raise his voice, but he doesn't know how to modulate it.
That's Randy Credico, political activist, comedian, one of our favorite guests here at Loud and Clear. We're talking about the Andrew Cuomo debate with Cynthia Nixon.
There was one thing I wanted to ask Randy. There was a point in the debate where Cynthia Nixon criticized Cuomo. Well, Cuomo had said how proud he was that Donald Trump tweets at him about once every week and criticizes him. And he wears that as a badge of honor, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And she cracked on him immediately because she said, sure, Donald Trump tweets at you because when he said America was or make America great again or keep America great, you said America wasn't great. He criticized you and you immediately backed down, which was true. He did.
Right.
What was the response to that? Because it seemed to me like she was way better prepared than he was. She made the stronger political points. And, you know, for the first time last night, I took her seriously as a candidate.
Yeah, and he's just such a machine hack.
Oh, it's
and
just
as
terrible.
Randy is saying, opportunist.
Oh, yes.
One of the worst persons I have. Look, Rudy Giuliani endorsed him in 2014. Rudy Giuliani and his father had this deal in 1993. It wasn't for Andrew's father, Mario, holding back and letting out this this report on Crown Heights, Rudy would have never won, which was devastating. He waited and made sure it was released just before the election in 1990, which catapulted Rudy Giuliani over David Dinkins. His father did that.
And just so our audience who won't know if they weren't there in New York and around at that time, that was just pure racism, actually. I mean, New York City was 80% Democrat. Giuliani was running as Republican. David Dinkins was the first black mayor of New York City. And somehow Giuliani ousted him during his reelection campaign with Cuomo's help. But that was, for all of us who were living in New York at the time, you just know, we knew this was pure anti-African-American, anti-black racism.
This is exactly the reason why Giuliani endorsed him over George Pataki a few years later. It all ties back to 1998, I guess. It all ties back to what Mario did for Rudy, and he got the quid pro quo a few years later. And definitely racism is a factor. You know, if you take a look at the Cuomo administration, it's like the Dean administration in Vermont, but Dean at least had an excuse. There's a small percentage of African Americans in the state of Vermont, and you got, you know, so many African Americans and Latinos. His administration is like the Rockies. The higher you go, the wider it gets with Andrew Cuomo. So it's just like a big white sundae, all right? One of those chocolate sundae. It's all white at the top. Well, that's the way it is with Andrew Cuomo. It's the most it's conservative. He is conservative on so many levels. We don't even have medical. We don't have marijuana. We have medical marijuana, but it's in pills. And we're supposed to be the big progressive state. So what did he pass same-sex marriage? It's like everywhere.
It's the dirty little secret of the Democratic Party of New York. But we're out of time, Randy.
Oh, no, I'm just getting started. Oh,
that was the voice of Randy Cretico.
I thought that was Andrew Cuomo. Wait, that's Randy?
And Andrew Cuomo.
Don't let me down, please. I'm going to lose to Nixon. Oh, my God.
Imagine. He joined us from New York. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Environmental groups yesterday argued in a federal appeals court that the Environmental Protection Agency should revoke its approval of a potent weed killer because it evaporates quickly, destroys nearby crops, and kills wildlife. The groups say that Monsanto's Xtendimax weed killer is a health hazard and should be banned immediately. We're joined from Virginia by Alexis Baden-Meyer, the political director for Organic Consumers Alliance. Alexis, welcome.
Thank you.
Alexis, tell us about this Xtendimax. I had never heard of it really until I started to research this segment. And this is a very, very potent weed killer that also can kill people.
That's right. Now, Monsanto has had somewhat of a failure with its glyphosate-based Roundup herbicides. The big failure that is hurting them in the marketplace right now is that it's created super weeds. So farmers, you know, they were promised this weed-free system. You spray our herbicide. You can spray it all the time. You'll never have to deal with or worry about weeds. Well, it just wasn't the case. The weeds adapt quickly, and now they're super weeds. You can spray as much Roundup on them as you want, but the weeds keep coming back. And this is a huge economic concern for farmers, and they've been complaining to Monsanto. So Monsanto goes back to these older herbicides, which, if you can believe something more dangerous than glyphosate, which we know causes cancer, we've got things like dicamba. And that's what the Xtendimax is, this idea that we'll just go back to an older, more dangerous herbicide, one that also can quickly vaporize and destroy neighboring crops. So what they're in big trouble with farmers right now is that in 2017, in just 1 year, 3.6 million acres of soybeans and other crops in 25 states were destroyed because of their use of dicamba herbicide drifting on to crops that don't have that GMO protection of being dicamba resistant.
You know, I want to ask you about this dicamba because this came up in a lot of different articles I looked at, and it reminds me of those old stories about rats in New York City, that the city began putting poison out in whenever it was, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the rats became almost immune to the poison, to the point where by the 1980s and 1990s, the rats were dying when they couldn't get the poison to eat. Is that what we're seeing here with these super weeds?
Nearly. I haven't heard that the weeds need the herbicide to survive. but it's pretty close. I mean, certainly, you know, the farmers are needing to use more and more and more dangerous insecticides and herbicides with this pesticide treadmill that companies like Monsanto have created for their own profit, knowing that eventually one technology will have to be replaced with a new technology, and they'll have multiple products that farmers are reliant on.
So what are we looking at here in terms of direct threats to the health of humans? We know that this chemical evaporates very quickly. We know that it's extraordinarily potent. It damages nearby crops. It kills wildlife. Let's talk about the short-term consequences and the long-term consequences.
Well, certainly you can die from exposure to extreme amounts of dicamba. But also, like with other pesticides, it's a cancer risk. You can have reproductive and developmental problems in babies that are born to people exposed to dicamba. So it's very similar to the risks of many pesticides, where we have long-term health problems, and obviously you can, you know, farm workers regularly die because of exposure to extreme amounts of pesticides.
I'm looking at a piece that ran in Reuters today. It says the United States has faced a weed killer crisis caused by the new formulations of dicamba-based herbicides, which farmers and weed experts say have harmed crops because they evaporate and drift away. The EPA's declaration that Extendamax would have no effect on plants and animals was arbitrary and capricious, according to Paul Achitoff, a lawyer for the nonprofit Earth Justice. He was talking to a three-judge panel at the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle. Monsanto, of course, spends millions and millions of dollars on lobbying and on law firms all around the country to push these approvals through. It's interesting to me that this case has gotten to the appellate level. The only next step is the Supreme Court. How do you see this issue playing out?
Well, I think this has just created such a disaster for farmers that courts are going to have to step in. Supposedly this GMO and pesticide technology is supposed to feed the world, right? It's supposed to ever increase our ability to produce food. I argue with that, of course, because most of the so-called food that's being produced is used as ethanol, food for animals in factory farms, producing ingredients like high fructose corn syrup. So I take issue with that whole feed the world stance, but at least in practice, it's supposed to make money for farmers. And when you have a product that's so dangerous in terms of its environmental impact, destroying neighboring fields and fields, you know, more than a mile away, you have an economic crisis for farmers, one that courts can't easily ignore, the way that the human health risks have been ignored up until the point that we got the Monsanto lawsuits from our first Roundup exposed cancer victim, who was victorious in the courts against Monsanto and just recently got a $289 million judgment because of his exposure to Roundup and getting non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So we're starting to see a little bit of justice here for individuals harmed by these products. But when you've got thousands of farmers across the country, conventional farmers in the industrialized food system who are being damaged by Monsanto, I can't imagine that the courts would be able to ignore that. I'm surprised that politicians are ignoring that. That doesn't seem like a wise choice on their part.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Alexis, I wanted to ask you specifically about dicamba. Dicamba was developed because some weeds became resistant to glyphosate, as you said at the beginning of this segment. So both have been developed by Monsanto. It seems only logical then that when weeds become resistant to dicamba, Monsanto is going to try to create something even more potent. Is there a way to stop this vicious cycle where we're going to end up just simply poisoning ourselves?
Well, yes. In fact, many farmers produce nutritious, abundant food organically. You can go into any grocery store in the United States today. Walmart has become the biggest seller of organics. We've got Costco. All of the major grocery stores are selling organic food. And while it's still something of a niche market, we haven't reached market saturation, but consumers want it. Certainly, most consumers are buying organic whenever it's available and whenever they can afford it. And we've got some issues around that because we subsidize industrial agriculture and make the junk food cheap, where the organic vegetables are far more expensive. So we've got some food justice issues that we obviously need to deal with. But there's another way that's been proven and just even proven in the American marketplace.
We're speaking with Alexis Baden-Meyer. She is the political director for Organic Consumers Alliance. Now that we're on the topic of organic foods, tell us about your organization and how people can get involved. And let me add, too, that I always stayed away from organic foods only because of the price. And finally, I started, making a little bit of money, and I moved over to organic. And I have to tell you, the difference is dramatic. Organic milk, organic meats, for example, the taste is better. The shelf life is longer. It's a complete difference. And my kids are in love with organic foods. So tell us about your organization and how people can get better involved.
Well, we're the Organic Consumers Association. You can find us at organicconsumers.org, and you can find Organic Consumers Association on Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, all social media channels. And we're actively looking for activists who want to communicate with their members of Congress, their school boards and school districts about the use of pesticides. So if this issue grabs you, we need you in our network working on this. We've got this golden opportunity now that the courts are finally recognizing the human health harms and the harms that are economic harms to farmers, the problems with these products that Monsanto has made money from for so long. We've got this opportunity now to act, and we have to take it to the political realm. So if you're interested, contact me. I'm alexis@organicconsumers.org.
Fantastic. I want to echo that point, too. We don't have to go just to the courts. We can go to Capitol Hill and lobby our members of Congress. Remember, they work for us, and they are actually responsive. We're out of time. We were joined from Virginia by Alexis Baden-Meyer. She's the political director for Organic Consumers Association. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio, and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.